This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The regimes like this junta, are desperate to protect themselves. They're interested in their own survival. And so they're not thinking in terms of counterterrorism strategy. They're not thinking about national security. They're not thinking about strategy. They're not thinking strategically. What they are thinking about is just like, well, how do you stay in power?
That's Sahel expert Michael Shokrain on Niger's junta calling the U.S. military presence in its country illegal. Details coming up also. 44-year-old president-elect Bassirou Diomaye Faye becomes the youngest president in Senegal's history. And the United States is considering April 18th for the potential resumption of Sudan peace talks in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The observation mission deployed to Senegal by the European Union and West Africa's regional bloc have praised the smooth running of the presidential election won by anti-establishment opponent after 3 years of unrest. Around 7.3 million Senegalese were eligible to take part in Sunday's vote, which saw 44-year-old Bassirou Diomaye Faye elected as the youngest president in the country's history after his main rival and government candidate, Amadou Ba, conceded defeat. The French news agency AFP reports that officials with the Economic Community of West African States said voting went smoothly and in a largely peaceful atmosphere. The EU mission praised a well-organized, orderly and open election that demonstrated the strength of Senegal's democratic institutions. ECOWAS has deployed 130 observers and the EU another 100. Official provisional results are due to be published this week, but Faye's opponents in the race and outgoing President Macky Sall have already acknowledged his victory. Thousands of people have started gathering in Gabon for what the government calls an inclusive national dialogue aimed at bringing the country back to civilian rule. Military ruler General Brice Clotaire Oligua Nguema previously said he would hand back power in August of 2025. Opposition groups say the dialogue should not be a ploy for military leaders to hang on to power. Moke Edwin Kinzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
President de la République, chef de l'État, le Bureau du Dialogue National Inclusif.
Colonel Ulrich Manfumbi, spokesperson for the Committee for the Transformation and Restoration of Institutions, reads the names of 28 military officials, clerics, traditional rulers, and civil society and opposition leaders. He says General Nguema has chosen as officials of the Inclusive National Dialogue Jean-Patrick Iba, head of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Libreville, will preside over the deliberations. Gabon's state TV on Wednesday reported that several thousand people are already in the towns of Akanda and Libreville, where the dialogue will take place from April 2 to 30. It says the participants will include opposition and civil society members. But Gabon's opposition parties say a majority of the about 600 delegates are supporters of General Nguema, who wants him to stay in power. They also say many of the civilians traveling to Libreville and Akanda were hired by military rulers to give a false impression that Nguema is popular. The government has refuted that claim. Judicial Obiang Meyong is head of an opposition group, the Movement to Act for Gabon's Freedom and Independence. He says it is surprising that Gabon's military leaders are inviting many of the same officials, party leaders, clerics, and traditional rulers who took part in previous dialogues that failed to solve the country's multiple problems.
Nous retrouvons encore là la prépondérance des acteurs politiques de partis politiques.
He says those dialogues were organized to extend the rule of Gabon's first president, Omar Bongo Ondimba, and when Omar Bongo died on June 8, 2009, a series of other dialogues attended by Bongo's collaborators was organized to extend the Bongo family rule. The Bongo family ruled Gabon for more than half a century. General Nguema is a cousin of President Ali Bongo, who the military overthrew in August of last year. Myung said military rulers should have asked civilians whose opinions were not taken into consideration by former regimes to meet in each of Gabon's 9 provinces, outline their needs, and elect people to represent provinces at the dialogue. But Gabon's government says more than 50,000 suggestions were received when Nguema asked civilians to give proposals on issues to be discussed during the one-month dialogue. Francis Edgar Simamba, a political science lecturer at the Libreville-headquartered Omar Bongo University, says the dialogue is, so far, the most representative in Gabon's history.
Vous avez la diaspora qui est représentée, vous avez les partis politiques légalement reconnus au nombre de 104.
He says for the first time in Gabon's history, citizens of the Central African State who are in exile and political refugees and their peers in the diaspora will be taking part in a national dialogue. Mba says for the first time, all civil society groups and Gabon's 104 political parties will each send a representative to the dialogue, unlike in the past, when only opposition and civil society close to the ruling government was invited to talk. General Nguema says he will respect decisions made at next month's dialogue. A March 10 decree signed by Nguema says that the dialogue will pave the way for the drawing up of a new constitution, determine the duration of the transition, and propose the political, economic, and social organization of the Central African nation after the transitional period. Opposition and civil society groups say Gabon's transitional government should respect an initial plan it published to hand power to civilian rule. According to that plan, the transition is to last 24 months, ending in August 2025, with free, credible and fair elections. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The United States is considering April 18th for the potential resumption of Sudan peace talks in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, as part of Washington's efforts to prevent the conflict from escalating into a regional war. Tom Perriello, U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, says the talks need to be inclusive, involving the African Union, the Eastern African bloc IGAD, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi has the details.
Perriello is fresh from a trip to meet with Sudanese across Uganda, Ethiopia, Kenya, Djibouti, and Egypt, as well as meeting with African and U.S. counterparts in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. He warns that Sudan's conflict is not just a disaster for civilians, but could easily become a more factionalized and regional war. He referred to an important donor conference in Paris on April 15 to relieve Sudan's humanitarian crisis as a natural step to return to Jeddah if the Saudis host inclusive talks. Perriello stressed that the United States' priority is to get a peace deal that ends the violence, immediately ensure full humanitarian access to all citizens, and returns the country to the civilian transition process that Sudanese people risked so much to create just a couple of years ago.
The Sudanese people could not be more unified and clear. They want an end to this war now. They want full humanitarian access, and they want their future back. And it is our job, all of us who care about the people of Sudan, around the world, around this neighborhood, and beyond, to be urgently seized with the project of ending this war, preventing the worst of this famine, and giving the Sudanese people a chance to determine their own future.
Priello said the only true solution is to silence the guns, and that's going to require not only General Burhan and General Hemeti to reach a deal, but also for all parties across the region to be partners in peace, particularly those who have been fueling the conflict. The United States Special Envoy said several important efforts to mediate between the warring parties by hosting talks in Jeddah, Cairo, Manama, and other places need to become broader and more inclusive to end the war.
We need to restart formal talks. We hope that will happen as soon as Ramadan is over, that those are inclusive talks of key regional actors as well as key voices from the inside, and that we can reach that agreement not just to end the violence, but to really open up to full humanitarian access. So we are looking forward to, hopefully, a restart of those talks as soon as Ramadan has ended.
Priello said it's important to engage with all voices. That specifically includes General Burhan, who has a role to play in ensuring humanitarian access and a peace process goes forward.
I think there's alignment here about the desire for a unified Sudan, for a strong, unified professional army, and for a Sudan where the Sudanese people get to determine their future. And we'll be sitting down with all actors who are prepared to help make that future a reality.
Priello met with over 100 Sudanese from across all regions and civil society on the trip, and he said that every single one wants an end to the war. He said that's how we are informing our U.S. policy: an end to the war, access to basic humanitarian goods, and the dignity to define a future that includes a strong, unified armed force, as well as an opportunity for people to determine their future. Mohammed Al-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Last week, Niger's military declared on TV the presence of U.S. troops in the West African nation is illegal. American officials are seeking private talks to see if they can keep some sort of security presence in Niger, traditionally a key U.S. ally in the region. Sahel expert Michael Shukrain, director of global programs at 14th North Strategies, a business intelligence firm, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam, the U.S. is walking a tightrope between trying to communicate its displeasure with the junta's July military coup and its desire for elections and a return to civilian rule.
And on the other hand, though, there's been this desire to try to communicate this willingness to work with them, this sort of realistic view that, like, okay, well, this is the government that there is, whether we like it or not. We need to work with these people, and we want to salvage also. We've got these bases. We want to keep the bases. We've got our guys there. We've got our whole counterterrorism strategy. We want to try to salvage that. We don't want to just walk away, and we don't want to walk away from a huge investment. So how do we do this? So that's what we've been doing. We've been sort of working diplomatically, first sort of supporting sanctions and then softening the sanctions and giving, and I believe we first like cut off World Bank assistance and then we turned it back on, and just trying to sort of show that, look, we're not happy, but we can play ball with you guys. So let's play ball. Let's like not walk away. Let's not have any hard feelings. Let's sort of keep moving forward. We always felt like we had to have this double message, like, yes, we'll work with you, but at the same time, we're going to scold you, right? That doesn't come out too well.
But how much of do you think this statement and just, you know, the posturing, I guess, of the military leaders there is, you know, for their public consumption? And are they really trying to work with the U.S. and in keeping something, at least like maybe a smaller military force there in the country?
Well, okay, so this is a really important question you're asking, which is whether or not it really mattered at all from the beginning what the U.S. did or didn't do, because ultimately the regimes like this junta, are desperate to protect themselves. They're interested in their own survival. And so they're not thinking in terms of counterterrorism strategy. They're not thinking about national security. They're not thinking about strategy. They're not thinking strategically. What they are thinking about is just like, well, how do we stay in power? Well, we've got power, so how do we stay here? And so ultimately what they're doing is they're acting in light of this very domestic, very local political calculus. In this context, defiance towards the United States, just like defiance towards France, pays dividends with respect to a certain part of the population that really likes that kind of thing. So the Americans, I think, have been hoping that ultimately what Niger wants is they just need a the right deal. And this is just like a negotiation tactic. But I'm not convinced. I know a lot of people are not convinced, and I tend to side with them, that ultimately, at the end of the day, what Niger wants, what the junta wants, is simply its own self-protection. They just want to hang on. And ultimately for them, they're going to act according to what they think is their short-term requirements, which is that they have very little legitimacy and they need to shore up their legitimacy. And they're going to justify what they've done, their whole coup, in terms of this kind of defiance towards the West in the name of sovereignty, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is post facto self-justification, because all the evidence suggests that the reason for the coup had nothing to do with any kind of strategic thinking. It was just purely personal ambition.
One of the things that the statement said that was read on Saturday night was that this recent delegation of American officials that met with the Nigerian military leaders there had displayed a so-called condescending attitude and tried to dictate which countries Niger could talk to or have relationships with. What did you make of that?
You know, they didn't even meet, and they cited some tactical details, which I thought was kind of, it's just ridiculous. You should meet the American delegation. And I felt like they're grasping for excuses. But at the same time, it's also possible that the U.S. delegation was, in fact, in the way the Americans' diplomats, they've been saying is, you know, we really don't like that you're working with the Russians. There's also this concern about the Iranians. Niger has uranium. And so there's apparently concern about Iran getting access to the uranium, because, of course, Iran has a nuclear weapons program. It's possible that American diplomats were talking about that, and we're also doing it in a very patronizing way. I don't want to rule that out. But at the same time, I also feel like the Iranians and the Nigerians, they're grasping for straws. They're coming up with excuses.
That was Sahel expert Michael Shukrin, director of global programs, talking to VOA's Carol Van Dam. Officials say it could take years to rebuild a major bridge that crumpled and collapsed after a cargo ship loaded with shipping containers ran into a key support pillar in a port in the U.S. state of Maryland. The stunning incident in the city of Baltimore's harbor was captured on video that aired around the world. Six construction workers who were filling potholes on the bridge are missing and are feared dead. A last-minute warning from the ship, which reported it was suffering from power outages, cleared the bridge and saved more lives. For more on the incident and its aftermath, I talked to Anthony Labruto on the phone from the scene, and I first asked Anthony to describe the catastrophic collapse.
This bridge collapse was really incredibly catastrophic, because the container ship directly collided with the Francis Scott Key Bridge's underground support columns that was under the water, which caused almost the entire above-ground structure to collapse into the Baltimore Harbor. And so it's a little cloudy where I am for right now in the harbor, but I can just barely make out some of the ends of the bridges, which are still standing. But this bridge is almost a mile and a half long, and it's completely blocked off the port of Baltimore.
Have search and rescue crews been able to make any progress in finding the still missing persons?
Sadly, no. The search and rescue crews really haven't made any progress. There's still six people that are currently missing that are among construction crews that were working on the bridge during the time when it fell at 1:30 this morning. You know, I've seen boats go up and down the rivers, the Patapsco River, but now a diving team has been dispatched, and you can see them, you know, to look underwater for anyone still potentially trapped. But the likelihood of finding any one of the six still alive sadly appears to be going down.
And lastly, Anthony, can you give us your sense of what will now happen now that the bridge has collapsed?
So this bridge collapse really, unfortunately, was a nightmare scenario. So authorities will now have the task of not only cleaning up and rebuilding the bridge, but doing so really as quickly as possible. And so to give our African perspectives, or African listeners, excuse me, a little bit of a perspective on how significant this port is to the United States, it currently handles both the container volume of the port of Mombasa and the port of Durban combined almost every year. And so that's about 13,000 jobs specifically being affected on the port, as well as another 130,000 indirectly within the city. And so not only that, the bridge itself carries the Interstate 95, which is also one of the most significant roads on the eastern coast of the United States. So internal goods being shipped from, you know, southern Florida all the way up to the north of Maine will be affected.
That was VOA reporter Anthony Labrato. Kenyan authorities. Kenyan authorities are releasing the bodies of several people linked to a doomsday starvation cult so their families can bury them. Hundreds of bodies, including those of children, have been exhumed from shallow mass graves discovered in a remote wilderness, followed by nearly a year of painstaking work to identify them using DNA. Self-professed pastor Paul Ntenge Mackenzie is alleged to have incited his followers to starve to death in order to meet Jesus in what has been dubbed the Sakola Forest Massacre. Mali's ruling junta has decreed a ban on the activities of a rare new opposition coalition in Bamako, citing threats of disturbance to public order. The country has been under military rule since back-to-back coups in 2020 and 2021, with the security situation compounded by a humanitarian and political crisis. The coalition, named Action Synergy for Mali, was set up in February and is made up of 30 opposition parties, including supporters of an influential imam, Mahamadou Diko. According to the French news agency AFP, the governor of the district of Bamako said the ban on the group was due to the security situation and the risk of threats to public order. Authorities point to multiple actions by the coalition that are said to be in violation of current regulations. The coalition rejects the ban, calling it an illegitimate and illegal decision that violates the freedom of association and expression guaranteed by the Constitution.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA. VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
Ghana's finance ministry wants to speed up negotiations to restructure $13 billion debt in the form of international bonds. The West African country has been overhauling its debt as it tries to emerge from its worst economic crisis in a generation with the help of a $3 billion program for the from the International Monetary Fund. Ghana defaulted on most of its $30 billion external debt on December 2022 after debt costs and inflation spiraled sharply higher. Reuters says the government reached a deal in principle in January to restructure $5.4 billion of loans with official creditors. The Ministry of Finance says the government has received counter-proposals from two bondholders that would be assessed. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all these developments on the continent 24/7, please visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.